is Greta Talk, and this is different from On the Record at 7 p.m., which, of course, you watch on the Fox News Channel Monday through Friday. This is my chance to talk in greater depth with some of the most fascinating people, and there's probably no one nicer in the business than my guest now, Geraldo Rivera. Geraldo, nice to talk to you.
I feel the same about you. You've always been so gracious with me, and so honest and straightforward, and you always, anything you say publicly has always been so supportive. I love you.
You know, Geraldo, one time I was out in California with him. We'll get off this love fest in a second. I was out in California and covering the Scott Peterson trial, and there were people lined up around the block to get your autograph, and the rest of us were sort of anxious to leave and hungry and maybe irritable. You were so nice to everybody.
My rule when meeting people, even under the most exigent circumstances, generally speaking, is to be as nice as I possibly can be, on the theory that that's the only time they're ever going to see me, and whatever they think of me from that point on in their life will be based on the 15 seconds we spend together. So I try my best to be nice to people. Just, you know, and people, generally speaking, are very loving, I find. Even if they may, if they're on Twitter or something like that, say something nasty in person, I tell you, Greg, I honestly believe that 99% of my encounters with regular folks have been pleasant and polite. Whether they're gangbangers or Park Avenue matrons, it really doesn't matter. I find that people, generally speaking, have a pretty good vibe. A lot of people, because I've been on television so long, 46 years, think that they know me better than they know their neighbors or some of their own cousins. You know, it's amazing. They've seen me grow up, grow through middle age, become now an old man. They have different markers along my career. They knew me from the local news in New York, or Good Night America, or 2020, or Good Morning America, or these other various programs, my daytime talk show. A lot of people, I can almost tell what people, how people are relating to me by their age, because I know what I was doing 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
Well, the first thing people always say to me when they come up to me is, oh, you're so short. And I say I play a tall person on TV. And the other thing, which once surprised me, is someone came up to me and we were talking for a few minutes, and at the end said, wow, you have a sense of humor. And I thought to myself, oh, good. I'm like some jerk on the TV usually, you know, like a shrew that has no sense of humor.
That's a backhanded compliment.
That's a backhanded compliment. All right, so Dancing with the Stars was fun?
It was fun, and a lot more positive and experienced than Celebrity Apprentice, which I did last year. Celebrity Apprentice, everybody is in it for themselves, and they conspire amongst themselves to eliminate. I mean, in my case, I had three people who were Ian Ziering, Kevin Jonas, and Lorenzo Lamas. They got together on the first day and said, we got to get rid of Geraldo. And they were doing like horrible things, stabbing me in the back. Dancing with the Stars was just the opposite. It was people, you know, I had a relatively short tenure there, just a couple of episodes. But the people I met were very supportive. They were very collaborative. Collegial, very camaraderie, filled with camaraderie, helpful, cheering you on. It was a very nice, warm environment that I enjoyed.
I was rooting for you, so I regretted that you didn't make it. All right, O.J. Simpson.
Well, isn't that something?
Where were you? Do you remember where you were when you first heard about the murder?
I had a program, Rivera Live, on CNBC. I had gone on the air in April. This was June 1994, and I got to the newsroom, and we were still struggling with the program to decide what the program was going to be, Rivera Live. Roger Ailes had hired me. He had taken over CNBC. So he had hired me. I'd known Roger from years before. We had met through Jerry Weintraub, who was my agent and a good friend of Roger's. Anyway, Roger had hired me. I had this program. I didn't know what to do with it. Then I came to the newsroom, as I always did after my taping my daytime show, and I looked up at the monitor, and I saw the white Bronco on the 405. There it was. And I said, what's that? And then as that story unfolded, I said, first of all, we couldn't take my eyes off the screen. I was riveted to the screen. I said at the side of my mouth to Bob Fassbender, the producer, whatever you have booked, this is what we're doing tonight. This is our story. And it was right there. It happened right there. It happened as it was happening. I began obsessing professionally over that saga.
All right, and you know what? Let me give you a little trouble. Tell you about a little trouble you gave us over at CNN, because your numbers were through the roof, and everybody at CNN was watching how you were doing it. You were taking a lot of transcripts. You were using a lot of transcripts. We were thinking, where's Geraldo getting the money for those transcripts? Because, I mean, daily transcript copies are expensive. But we were dying how you were beating us so much and, like, some good ideas over there. I mean, it's like we were watching.
We had what I call the depo cam. I had the theory, and it turned out to be correct, that if you didn't have a picture, even words can be interesting. That sense that you were getting an inside take on this notorious, you know, the world obsessing over this story, was compelling. And it really took this infant cable news network, CNBC at that time, and we soared to relative parity with the old veterans at CNN.
Did you ever think in the early on that it was going to get the life it did? I mean, even to the point now with the FX people watching the fictionalized account. But did you dream or think when it first got started it could be like what happened?
From that moment in the newsroom, seeing the Bronco, I knew that that was going to be a huge story because it had everything. I mean, the fact is that everybody knew who O.J. Simpson was. He was a great celebrity. He was adored. He was
beloved. Had you ever met him before?
Only in passing, and never, and I don't pretend to have any prior relationship with him. Everyone knows O.J. Everybody knew O.J. Everyone had met O.J. And then here he is accused of this hideous crime. And the facts as they develop with the domestic violence and, the race angle became paramount. It became all about becoming a kind of a metaphor for everything that was happening in America. You know, the celebrity, how a celebrity can avoid consequence, the racial divide in the country, the domestic violence, the Hollywood. It became everything. It became a story that I think came to symbolize the 90s.
Well, it almost became, though, at some point, you know, whether you're, what's the expression, pickup basketball, skins or shirts or something? What is something like that? Which team are you on? Everyone picked a team, which was sort of odd. Are you team the Brown family, or are you team OJ? Or are you team prosecution? I mean, that was what was sort of weird. It's like everyone got so whooped up into this.
I think that it was so brutally along racial lines that what it revealed was that race is the biggest unresolved domestic issue in the country. Johnny Cochran, brilliant Johnny Cochran, and watching it, that final episode and his summation and the glove doesn't fit, you must have quit, and all the rest of it. He knew what was happening. He had no case. He made Mark Furman his case. He saw the racial divide, and he drove a train through it.
It was extraordinary. Johnny Cochran was someone everybody, you couldn't help but like Johnny. You know, he was a nice man.
Well,
you demonize him?
No, but I met him years later after he had been selected the top lawyer in the country.
Well, that's what I mean, later
brought
on.
His fame, brought his firm nationally. I think that he was very, very admirable and an excellent, excellent attorney. I think the job that they did, though, I think that as in the final episode of FX reminded me, how Bob Shapiro in the interview with Barbara Walters says, we not only played the race card, we dealt it from the bottom of the deck. That was true. They exploited that and as a result got a man who butchered two innocent people, including one he had abused in a way that was despicable over the years, his wife and the mother of his children. He slaughtered them. He almost cut her head off, and because of Johnny's skill as an attorney. I mean, obviously, we both admire great lawyers, and we use look at Casey Anthony. Even my friend Jose Baez, he did a mini version of that, and I still admire him. I admire them, but looking at it in terms of justice, it just seemed to me that was the classic injustice.
Well, you know, O.J. did it. I mean, I don't think there are very few. Actually, you know who? F. Lee Bailey is probably the only person I know who says he didn't do it at this point.
He still believes that?
I know about a year ago or 2 years ago he sent me something. He sent me this long theory about what happened. So that was, you know,
rather... the son did it?
I know some. I think it was. They think they're still back on the Columbian something or other. Do you remember that theory?
Something. They're in the world of Faye Resnick.
Yeah. What stunned me most was the California court system. I've tried so many murder cases, and with more charges than two dead bodies, which is what we had here. I mean, multiple things, multiple other crimes, and it would take at most 6 weeks. This became a drama, and it went on and on and on.
The cameras had a lot to do with it.
I think it's the California system.
You do?
Yeah, they've got, I mean, they can't.
The system or the celebrity culture?
No, the system. I mean, it's like, because first of all, they don't have long days. We work long days here in D.C. in the court system. But Roger Cossack, who was my co-person on it, I always give him a hard time. I say, why don't you guys work longer hours? My God, in that court system of yours. And, you know, I was stunned at how long that dragged out. And I think that hurt the prosecution.
It was fun. Not fun. I don't know if that's the word I should use. But it was interesting meeting all the players in real time over the Browns and the Goldmans. And, you know, Judge Ito ultimately called me in his chambers at one point, and the attorneys. It was fascinating to see these players in this drama that was affecting everybody. You know, it was interesting, the finale, where I don't know if it really happened, but John Travolta as Shapiro says of the jury and their deliberations, you know, 4 hours, of which an hour was spent filling out the form. The other hour was the break for lunch. So it was actually 2 hours of deliberation. The Travolta character, Shapiro, the attorney, says they talked about this case less than anybody else in the country, the jury.
Well, that's probably true.
And it was probably true.
Wow.
Their minds were made up.
I always did feel sorry for Chris Darden, the prosecutor with Marsha Clark, that whole glove thing. And everyone said, basically, how could he have done that? He had absolutely no choice, because if he had not put that glove on O.J., and I grew up, you know, in a northern climate, and if your gloves get wet, the nuns put them on the radiator and they shrink.
Right.
Plus, O.J. put on weight in jail that year. Plus, he had latex gloves on. Those gloves were never going to fit him. But if Darden hadn't put the glove on, I would bet my right arm that Johnny Cochran would have, the first thing when they turn it over to the defense after prosecution rested, is have O.J. stand up and do that demonstration, and then turn to the jury in closing argument and say, why didn't the prosecution did that? Because they knew it didn't fit. So I think that would have come back and hit the prosecution even harder than it did. So I have sympathy for Darden on that.
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time with him after the verdict, certainly. I go back to the race thing. I don't think any of it mattered. I don't think any of it mattered. Once Johnny Cochran, remember, we're just a couple of years out of Rodney King now. The LAPD is considered by the black community as an occupying army. They hate the LAPD. I'm going back to 1994. I don't think anything the prosecution could have done would have worked once they raised the specter of racist cops.
But every time you walk into the courtroom, the jury is told by the judge to apply your common sense. And back then, as you talk about, there had been an awful lot of problems in the community with police and the community. Where I grew up, cops pull cats out of trees, you know, and do safety talks. At that time, what cops did, some police officers, you know, were there, they'd had a huge investigation there, and there was a lot of distrust of the police there. And that was their common sense. And so I know people went after the jury, but I sort of understood, you know, I understood why they came up with that verdict, even though O.J. was guilty.
You had the jury of 12. You had the one Hispanic man, two white women on the criminal jury. The two white women thought that O.J. was guilty. That was their first vote, guilty. In the civil trial, there was one black woman on the, I forget how many in the panel, one black woman. She was the only one that thought he was not civilly liable. All the white people went for the liability. She may have been an alternate, the black woman. I just think that this was one of those terrible cases. And I understand what you're saying, and I wish the world were so kind. I think it was brutally race loyalty. I think that it was so graphic that it should have been a wake-up call. That's why when President Obama ran for office and he talked almost tangentially about how the racial divide in the country has been made more apparent, and he listed some incidents, and he said, and most grotesquely or in a tabloid way, by the Simpson trial. I think he's wrong. I think that the Simpson trial was the clearest indication. When those cameras were on the white crowd and the black crowd in real time, you see how those different groups responded. I don't think black people, as a rule, cared specifically about that guilt, and I don't think white people. I don't think one's sentiments are any less valid than the other, but that was a race based verdict.
What a difference a civil trial. Of course, there's a lower burden of proof just being preponderance of the evidence, but they had the picture of O.J. Simpson wearing those Bruno Mali shoes, something that was never in the criminal trial. I mean, imagine, I wonder if that would have changed things at all. You don't think so?
You could have had a videotape.
You don't think that would have changed
things? Mark Furman, doctored the videotape. Mark Furman,
they would have said that.
The
they would have said that, you mean?
You know, I think so. I think so. I don't think anything they could have done. Absent a confession. I think that's the one thing they may have believed.
So did we do a disservice by putting cameras in there?
Obviously I'm selfish, and it certainly was the most interesting programming you could ever imagine. I don't think we would have been nearly as obsessed with the case if there were not cameras in that courtroom. We came to know every one of those characters. We came to know Marsha Clark and Chris Darden and the entire Dream Team. And, and to identify and to choose up sides. I think that I don't know. I selfishly want cameras in the courtroom. I don't think that it played that big a role in the jury's verdict. It certainly played a huge role in the interest of the public.
I think one topic about it that should have gotten a bigger spotlight is domestic violence. Because so many people knew that there was domestic violence going on in that relationship between O.J. Simpson, he's beating Nicole, and so many people just sort of looked the other way.
Well, the Browns certainly made domestic violence their cause after the trial.
Did they know about it during the marriage?
I have to believe that they did. Yeah.
And then, like so many others, kept hoping that it would end.
You hope
kept
against
hoping
hope.
Against hope it would end.
And it's O.J. It's O.J. It's this charismatic, beloved figure. How can Nicole be? She must be exaggerating. Maybe she's egging him on. Maybe she's aggravating him. Maybe she's cheating. You know, there's a million ways that millions of American families avert their glance from the reality of what's happened when some guy gets a drink in him and starts whacking his wife.
What do you think of the FX series overall?
It was like reliving my life. It was eerie.
The actors looked like the real people, didn't they?
I thought that this is John Travolta's best acting since, Urban Cowboy or, Staying Alive or, I think it was great. He was great. I thought the Kardashian Schwimmer was great.
He looked like Bob Kardashian.
And at the end, even O.J., what's his name, the actor?
Gooding?
Cuba Gooding. I think that he really, I didn't like him at first because he wasn't big like O.J. He wasn't commanding
physically
like
big.
O.J. But after a while, you forgot that, and he became O.J. And I think that the last episode, if you haven't seen it, you got to go on Netflix or whatever.
Well, I'm just starting it. I also thought the Marsha Clark character was
Sarah Paulson,
good. And how about Effley Bailey, Nathan Lane?
He
looked like Effley Bailey. I was sure it was Effley Bailey. At first I thought, is Bailey playing himself?
was great.
And
Dershowitz. Ido was fabulous. Fabulous. I loved it. I really did.
Where did they find these people that look like these people?
Carefully. But I hope that the concept of getting inside trials, remember, it was the Menendez brothers. It was a California case. The two brothers who killed their parents. They had cameras in the courtroom. That was the first of those.
Well, you had William Kennedy Smith down in Florida.
William Kennedy Smith with the black band over the victim. Yeah.
And it turned out to be an acquittal. And so, the question: who was the telling the truth?
And
That's
a tough one.
So, you like this business? TV?
You know, it's been my whole adult life. Let's face it. I mean, I was a lawyer for 10 minutes, and then I play a lawyer on TV. So I've grown up, and like I said, I've lived out my whole life. I got married, I got divorced, I got married, I got divorced, I got married, I had kid, I got divorced, I got married, I got divorced.
How many times have you been married?
Five. Huh. But I've been married for 15 years now.
I went to the most recent wedding 15 years ago.
Yeah, 2003. Well, we hooked up in 2000, but got married in 2003. Yeah, you were there.
That's fun. And to think that you played lacrosse in college?
Yeah, Arizona. University
you were pretty
Arizona.
Good, weren't you?
I was the goalie, yeah.
It's crazy how life is, isn't it?
Well, now I'm paying them back. I just dedicated the park there. Just now I'm thinking about legacy and leaving behind some enduring landmarks. So I care a lot about the U of A, the Wildcats, Bear Down, Arizona. And, I care about a lot about paying back. That's what I'm really focused on now.
Highlight of your TV career has been what? I said it slowly so you could think.
Thank you. There's no doubt but that the exposés on the care and treatment of the developmentally disabled, the institutions beginning with Willowbrook in New York City, is the high mark of my career.
That was big. That was huge. I tipped my hat to you on that. Huge.
And it helped change the way Western cultures deal with the developmentally disabled. It helped disable the institutional model for caring for people with, like, for instance, with Down syndrome or autistic young people. They were just warehousing them and just putting them all together where all the institutional abuses could happen. No remediation, no vocational training, no one-to-one care at all. So that was, and my life has largely, and it took, that was 1972, the original one. They closed that institution in 1987, so it took that 15 wow. years to do it. So it was a real crusade. And we've also, with John Lennon doing a benefit concert for me, the Allman Brothers, Charlie Daniels, Shanana, John Denver,
Peter Paul and Mary. I know these bands. Yeah, I've listened to them.
we raised a lot of money. My boxing matches over the years to raise money. My golf tournament is now in its 29th year to raise money. We've opened a lot of these community-based residences where instead of caring for the population in the hundreds or thousands, you deal with the folks in four people live in a home. They have one-to-one care. They have remediation. They have training. They have health care. They have jobs. Many of them get vocational skills. And that's been the if that's the first line of my obit, then I'm satisfied that I haven't lived in vain. It's the most important thing in my life.
It's funny. When people say to me, what's Geraldo like? I go, well, Geraldo's Geraldo. And then I say, and I'm going to end it on this, I say, Geraldo's just about the nicest guy you ever met.
Thank you.
Just about the nicest guy and the greatest colleague. So anyway, I'm going to end it on that. Remember, we're always adding to the Greta Talk collection. You can get the latest ones or catch up on the Greta Talk sessions you've missed at gretawire.com/podcast and gretatalk.com. We're also available on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher. Of course, watch On the Record on the Fox News Channel at 7 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday. You've been listening to my conversation with Geraldo, a really nice guy.
Thank you.
Everybody loves Geraldo here. That's the truth. We may fight with him, or some people may fight with him from time to time, but everybody loves Geraldo. Geraldo, thank you.
Thank you, Greta.